I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Tom Wolfe, a quarter of a century ago in his manifesto about the new journalism, said that the novel was dying because a new group of social literary upstarts were inventing a new genre called literary journalism. Dead, too, he said, was the old Hemingway career track, that slow ascent from deadline news writing to creative fiction. Tom Wolfe wrote that journalists knew enough about setting scenes and sketching characters to plunge right in, and they had the advantage over novelists, he said, in that everything they wrote was true. Tom Wolfe himself rose above the new journalism to write novels, but his idea of literary journalism has flourished, even though many of its traditional print vehicles have struggled. In The New Yorker, in Harper's, in the center column of the Wall Street Journal, on the web, and in papers around the country, readers can find lots of true stories faithfully reported in fine prose style. At a conference at Boston University in early December, writers, accomplished and would-be, gathered to read and talk about their craft. We tagged along to record these readings by writers Tracy Kidder, Joanne Wojcicki, Charlie Pierce, and Mark Kramer. And so for the next hour, here are some true stories well told. First, Tracy Kidder, the author of the book House, also Among School Children, and the 1982 Pulitzer Prize-winning Soul of a New Machine. Here, Tracy Kidder reads an excerpt from his book, Hometown, a book about Northampton, Massachusetts. This part of the book tells the story of Alan, a lawyer who made millions dealing in real estate around Northampton. It begins at a meeting on the day that Alan's life would change forever.
Alan sat in an office at a local bank at the end of another profitable real estate negotiation. The people at the table stood up and began being pleasant to one another. One of the men offered his hand to Alan. He couldn't remember the man's name anymore. This was just someone in a necktie, perfectly ordinary and presentable. After shaking hands with him, though, Alan felt that his own right hand had become not dirty, but contaminated. Suddenly, all of his attention focused on his hand. It might have just turned purple. And he realized with what seemed like great clarity, an insight, he called this, the first of many, that if he didn't immediately remove whatever it was that made his hand feel so alarmingly strange, then everything he touched with it would become contaminated too, and then all of those things would lie in wait for him to touch them again at a later time, contaminating his hand again. He excused himself and went to the men's room. He stood over the sink and did what one does when one's hand is dirty. He washed it, but it didn't feel cleansed, so he washed it again and again, about 20 times over, all motion and no progress. Finally, he realized, as if from a distance, that whatever had taken over most of the rest of his mind was saying he could stop. He couldn't shake with anyone after that day. For a while, he kept up appearances by tying an ace bandage around his right hand and telling people he'd injured it. He began having insights everywhere. He walked up to the door of the dry cleaners on Main Street, carrying his laundry bag. He shouldered the door open so as not to touch the handle and got in line behind a woman. She delivered a filthy-looking quilt to the clerk, who picked it up and put it in a basket. At that moment, another clerk relieved the first, who headed over to another section of the store and started pulling plastic bags over freshly dry-cleaned clothes. And to his horror, Alan experienced with what felt like every part of his body and mind a completely logical skein of thought, founded on illogic, yet irresistible. That clerk has been touching these filthy, contaminated, dirty clothes, and now she's touching people's clean clothes, and she's contaminating those clothes, he thought, as he stood in line. Okay, what's going on here is that your clothes are going in here dirty and coming out dirty, and even if they had someone else whose whole job was to pack plastic onto clean clothes, and that person never touched dirty clothes, the truth of the matter is that the dirty clothes are given to a man who puts them into a dry cleaning machine. Now look at that. He doesn't wash his hands after he puts them in the dry cleaning machine, and he doesn't disinfect or wash the handle of the door to the dry cleaning machine. So even if he washed his hands after he touched the dirty clothing, which he doesn't do, he contaminated his hands by opening the door to take out the dry cleaned clothes, and then when he touched the clean clothes, he'd contaminate them again. Soon all of Alan's suits and sweaters and sports jackets and slacks lay piled among other trash in his apartment. His former life had ended. He couldn't wear clothes that had to be dry cleaned, which meant that he couldn't dress up for court. He couldn't be a lawyer anymore. He couldn't shake hands. He couldn't touch doorknobs. Northampton's banquet was spread before him. There was nothing he couldn't afford to do here. Northampton was beautiful, and he couldn't touch it. In Paradise Lost, the fallen archangel says, the mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. By the mid-1980s, Allen would have said that the devil had a point. He knew he was a public spectacle. He went outside only when he had to, and he hurried home to his apartment in the tipsy-looking building. The windows were speckled with city grime, and the floors were littered, mostly with discarded paper. Inside his rooms, he moved along narrow pathways between chest-high piles of debris. For years, he had watched the rubbish accumulate, and for years, he had wanted to clean up, but another insight stymied him. There's no way I can put that stuff in garbage bags without contaminating both my clothes and the bags, and there's no way I could carry them down my staircase without touching the walls, and if my clothes or the bags are contaminated and they touch the walls, then I'll have to spend hours cleaning up the walls, and I already have far too much cleaning that I have to do, and besides, once I got the stuff outside, I'd have to deal with the lid of the dumpster or the incinerator, and both of those are grossly contaminated. He could still function intellectually, but he had less and less time for anything except his illness. It had progressed to an extreme. He had to spend nearly 11 hours a day in ritual cleaning of himself. Before he could touch his telephone, his only truly functional connection to the world outside, he had to shower for about 4 hours. He had to wash every square millimeter of his body, and if, when he was almost done, he realized or imagined that he'd missed a spot or accidentally brushed against the shower wall, he had to start washing all over again. He remembered that when he was a boy, he would wash and wax his father's cars, and invariably his father would say, "You missed a spot." Alan wondered if there was a connection. He had to spend about an hour and a half brushing his teeth before they felt clean. Back in Boston years before, he'd had some of his teeth broken in a car accident. The repairs hadn't weathered well, and now he brushed what remained so ardently that he began wearing ruts in them. A dentist told him that decay would destroy his teeth more slowly, but he had to brush for that hour and a half, then clean the spattered mirror and vanity very carefully, lest he contaminate himself again. If the trash in his apartment had contained food, his only safe place in the world would have become unbearable. So he had to go out to restaurants, hoping someone would be there to open the door for him. At best, that meant sitting in chairs others had occupied. Contaminated by the world outside, his own clothes became dangerous objects. So he had to wash them often, and once he'd washed them, no matter how carefully, he felt dirty and in need of showering once more. He couldn't let other people inside his rooms. They might touch the few crucial objects that he kept uncontaminated. Maybe that was just as well. He felt beyond embarrassment, not beyond shame, and he was ashamed of his rooms. That was the cruelest side of his illness, he thought. The compulsions that forced him to live in squalor didn't take away his ability to recognize the squalor or to see that the madness controlling him really was madness. In later years, Alan's illness, obsessive-compulsive disorder, would become quite justly famous, but most people didn't know much about it back then. Alan, always studious and thorough, had learned most of the facts available. He was what clinicians called a cleaner, and he understood with perfect clarity that mastering the proper names of symptoms is far from the same as having power over them. He'd spent time with a psychiatrist back when his symptoms still alarmed him, before they'd become his life, and the psychiatrist had told him there was no cure. He wasn't completely unhappy. While he sat imprisoned in his rooms overlooking Pleasant Street, his mind ranged far more widely than it ever had before. He had to spend about 2.5 hours sitting on the toilet. The time was usually that long because the moment he felt that he had finished evacuating his innards, he'd feel he hadn't. Unable to leave the toilet, Alan read. He consumed books there, among others, all of Edward Gibbon's The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. At times he felt something like peace falling over him, descending from despair. There are certain threads of existence that you abandon. It's just that you come to grips with the fact that you're not going to deal with them. He thought he could have been a monk, praying instead of washing my hands 400 times a day. He'd been only moderately well-read before. Now he lived in books and movies. He used his old rock and roll records to summon up memories where he could also go for a while. His experience was increasingly limited and intensified in proportion. He knew periods of great concentration. He escaped into them. Meanwhile, he considered suicide. Alan had a charming, roguish friend. He'd done a small business deal with him. Ever afterward, he would say that this was the kind of guy with whom you'd never want to be in business, though you'd always be glad to meet him for a beer. The friend had been trying to seduce a certain woman, and in order to impress her, had taken her to look at some apartments he'd had renovated. He took this woman to the apartment of a tenant who said he'd be away. He opened the door and saw the tenant hanging by the neck. The body had been there a while, a frightful sight. That very day, Alan's friend had begun a course of psychotherapy. Alan had sent away to the Hemlock Society for advice and read their pamphlets thoroughly. For him, he thought, carbon monoxide would be easiest. He had keys to his friend's garage and to one of the cars inside it. One night, he figured he'd get a little drunk and lock himself in there with the car running. He imagined his friend finding his corpse and rushing off again to a therapist. And he laughed in perverse amusement. Alan had a distinctive laugh that began with an ah and proceeded in an even tempo, ha, 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 and died away in a tone that sounded a little sorrowful, as if it's being over. But he wasn't ready to die yet. He often sat alone at one of his windows looking down at the street. The sounds of night in Northampton rose up to him, of music, happy voices, arguments. He watched the town pass by below, the friends on their way to restaurants, the drug dealers and swaggering homeboys, the body-pierced goths, the married couples, the lovers, the lesbian mothers pushing baby carriages, the homeless who rooted through the trash barrels, the staggering collegiates who appeared from the bar across Pleasant Street as night in Northampton began to end. And all of them seemed enviable because they were alive in the world. He sat for hours sometimes, gazing down with longing.
That was Tracy Kidder reading from his book, Hometown. The next story is by Joanne Wipajewski, a senior editor of The Nation magazine. The Secret Sharer appeared in Harper's magazine. It's a story about the Nushon Williams case. A young HIV-positive drug dealer from Brooklyn who moved to Jamestown in upstate New York and slept around, leaving a microdemic in his wake. Wipajewski focused on the women in the story. She reads two sections from the piece here, the first beginning with a quote from a song by rapper Puff Daddy.
Yeah, yeah. Feel me, baby? I've been away a long time. Is it still me, baby? The one on your mind. Can we creep where everybody's sleeping and fine? I sell between satin sheets intertwined. Can I touch you, baby? Is that alright with you? Can I love you, baby? What we about to do can make the whole earth move. I tell you my first move. Climb up in it slow. I ain't trying to hurt you. Can you feel me, baby?
At the health department, they say nothing links the girls who tested positive but Williams. No common social or medical profile. Dr. Neil Jevkovsky, a family physician who treats a lot of them, told me most of his patients had a prior history of sexually transmitted disease or had engaged in anal sex, but otherwise there is no type. In the first flush of the crisis, officials had said there was a very definite type, girls who traded sex for drugs. This persisted in the public mind even after the county sheriff asserted that in no way was it the case. Too many girls had started turning up talking about love. I was meeting mostly girls who had loosely moved in the same circle as Williams. Some, like Tanya, who'd never had sex with him but knew those who had, others who had, one who was positive. Although I've been told there were girls from well-off, solid families who'd had sex with Williams as a tryst with danger, these were all working-class girls, and they seemed to think the others' experiences weren't so different from their own. I drove along imagining the rapper's lyrics as a kind of baseline unifying the fragments of life history I'd heard. You're 17 and you left home years ago. Your mother bugged you or was tougher than you thought your father would be. Or she just threw you out. And you love her, but she never had much time. Or maybe she had time, but not as much as you wanted. You wanted it all. But she couldn't help it, really, because there were other kids and she had to work all the time. Or she could help it, but she spent all her time with her boyfriends and then got on you about yours. Or she paid too much attention, or there was too much fighting, or she was always sick, or you got pregnant, or you couldn't take another day of your father harping on everything you'd done wrong, or too many reasons you'd rather not talk about. So you're living with relatives, friends, families, or kids alone and in the same boat as you. You're working midnight to 8 to pay the rent and utilities, to pay for food and clothes. You're trying to go to school, but it's hard to stay awake, and it's a drag to be hassled as if you're a child. You're sick, and you need an excuse. The excuse is supposed to come from your mother, but you don't live at home. So the teacher says, well, get one from whoever you live with. So you get it from your girlfriend. She's who you live with. But the teacher thinks you're being smart, so you get in-school suspension. You don't mind that so much. Because at least you're with all the other kids who are always in detention, the bad kids, the ones who are just looking for a place to fit in. They'll accept anyone. You actually tried to be a prep once, because it's not like you're poor or nothing, but you had to dress a certain way, walk a certain way, talk a certain way. It was too much. And you dreamed of being a cheerleader, but you were too fat, or you were a cheerleader, but with everything else you were trying to keep together, it was too much. And you have average grades or below average grades, but it's been clear for a while that no one expects much from you. And anyway, school's a bore, so you drop out. You hear little kids counting the days till they can drop out, too, asking in school, can I drop out as soon as I turn 16, or do I have to wait until the end of the school year? Anyway, you hang out with your friends. There's not much to do unless you swim or play basketball. But you won't go to the Boys and Girls Club because that's for really grubby poor kids, these little kids who just piss in the pool and turn it yellow. And you don't like the Y because that's where the preps go, and they have this attitude they give to anyone who don't have as much as they do. Sometimes you go to JCC to play basketball, and that's fun, and there are girls who run track with this club Striders, and they go off to meets out of town, which is okay if you like to run, but if you don't, well, you don't. And there's just nothing to do in this town but get high and f***. Well, and hang out and play cards and watch black entertainment television on cable, but really nothing else. There used to be a teen club, and that was good, because you could go dance all night, but that closed up. You can't get into the bars unless you're 21. Well, you can sneak in, but the only really good DJ is at Rusty Nail. They got a good one sometimes at Rascals. No, Rascals a gay bar? Well, anyway, it's not like you drink much or get high that much, maybe a beer sometimes and some weed, though you know some kids who are in AA now because, you know, life is hard sometimes. And in this town, if you fall, you don't just miss a stair or two. You fall down the whole damn staircase. And it's not like you just sleep with anyone either. You're not like those little girls who are just whores, you know, real pigs who go with anyone. Those little girls are disgusting. And some of them are real shiesty bitches. You know, not what you'd call real women. The kind who talk behind your back and steal your man as soon as you go to jail. Oh, yeah, you can go to jail so easy in this town. Your boyfriend, he's black and from Buffalo. He was in jail for a month and a half for throwing a stick at a car. He was mad. He has problems with anger. So he threw this stick, and these white kids jumped out and started a fight, and one of them had an outstanding warrant. But your boyfriend's the only one got locked up. And you know this other boy. He's black and from Brooklyn. He knew Face there. He went to jail for 2 months for driving without a license. 2 months. You've been in jail a bunch of times, always for the little things, never for the big things. But those little things add up, or maybe they're not just little things. You were at a boot camp once. That was 18 months. And later you were in for 4 months, breaking probation, because you cursed out your landlord, said you'd blow up his house when he wouldn't do what you needed. You have problems with anger, too. But it's not like you have a history with explosives. Now you're through with the business, the pharmaceutical business. What do you think, selling drugs? Because you just don't want to be in jail again. You're 18, 19, and you're not talking about a little time now. But in the business, on a good night, you could make $3,000-$4,000 in a few hours. Jamestown is full of crackheads. And that's your beat packing boards or sorting screws for $5-$6. Yeah, you've had a hard life. You got to get out now. Maybe go to Atlanta where there's some culture. You and your boyfriend may have a chance in a black city. Nothing's easy, though. Your little sister thinks it's glamorous because you've been out on your own since you were 13, 14. But they don't know how hard it is, how real hard. It's not so bad, though. It's not like your friend in Rochester who has a 3-year-old kid by her mother's boyfriend who still lives in the house and visits her room every other night, and her room is right next to her mom's. Or like your girl in Buffalo who had HIV, maybe from Face nobody knows, and who was killed last year. It was an accident. A gun went off that wasn't supposed to. But you never had a friend who died before. She was 18. That was in Buffalo. And Buffalo's dangerous. Jamestown isn't dangerous. It's just boring. At a kitchen table one night in Jamestown, a fellow who calls himself Killer explained to me that the crew he leads, which he calls the Crips, but which seems a long way from the gang of his dreams, is like family and religion rolled into one. Listening to him describe his responsibility to instruct and discipline his children, to dominate his queen, and hearing his acolytes vow obedience was like an hour spent captive with the radio tuned to Dr. Laura. Yet what is spoken and what is true may differ. Earlier, when I talked with Killer's girlfriend alone, she'd characterized their relationship as one of tender honesty, in which they faced their weaknesses and pooled their strengths, in which they had decided to abandon the underground business as too risky, but were still trying to find a way out of their low-end factory jobs. Equality was assumed. She said that with every man, she insisted on using a condom. that she insisted with him until they committed themselves to each other and both had had HIV tests. Surrounded by his friends and subordinates, Killer put aside the jokey charm and imagined firearms and fucking with the police and big-time fraud. He said he'd never used a condom. He never would. Not even now. Not even to protect his queen. He'd rather die. So who is right? Probably both and neither. People burdened by fears have always sought to make something of a romance of their life, and others have sought to deny them their contradictions and protective self-deceptions. I have never spoken with Nushon Williams. His court-appointed lawyer in New York, William Sember, turns away journalists' requests for interviews and has warned Williams wisely that anything he says will be used against him by somebody. But there is no reason to suppose that Williams, alone among men, must be one-dimensional. It's regularly assumed, for instance, that every present he gave, every gentle thing he did, was a ploy to exploit a young woman. Now, he might not be a good man. He might be a little crazy. Psychiatrists report he is competent to stand trial, but that doesn't mean he has no problems. And he certainly was wrong not to tell his partners about the HIV. But at least sometimes, might not a gift have been just a gift, a gesture of feeling and a bid for notice? How many ways are there, after all, for a street dealer with scars all over his body and a heavy rap sheet to express eligibility, even if some girls say they go for thugs? Isn't it possible that he, too, might have been looking for love, that in the exchange for tokens and physical desire, the trade in self-esteem might have gone both ways? It was the way he carried himself, Amber said, that first attracted her to Williams, like a millionaire. I grasped something of that allure one Saturday after 2 a.m. at an all-night downtown diner called Mattia's. Jamestown's 50-odd bars had just closed, and the restaurant was full with the broken figures of what's left of white working-class culture. I'd seen such faces earlier in the ranch and the bullfrog, faces joyless and worn and just a little menacing, just enough to shame you for the freedom of your life and the outsider's curiosity that made you assume the right to impose on their rough dignity. At Mattia's, they were joined by a few soft drunks, a few frisky matrons, a few creamy prep types who looked like they wouldn't say shit if they stepped in it, and the drug dealers or drug dealer hangers-on who laughed and walked proud and with every flirtation or quick remark to a table of young women proclaimed, life. Girls who knew Williams say he was funny. He improvised songs and told silly jokes and put on accents. He could also be cruel and demand that they take off their clothes and get fucked when that's not exactly what they had in mind. Amber describes a life of alternating sweetness and brutality, in which she would hit him and let him cry in her lap for his childhood, in which he would choke her and put his arms around her in the dark and let her cry for hers, for her girlhood rape and all the pain behind her toughness. He cooked her spaghetti dinners, putting his own spices in sauce from a jar and lighting candles on the table. And in the afternoon, he had quick sex with others whom she tried not to think about or not to believe. About the violence which she remembered casually, almost as one would the events of a summer vacation, she said, obviously, I believe in second chances. I guess the reason I didn't leave is that I'm a violent person, too. He just had to say something smart and I'd hit him. I don't know. My dad used to hit me. My mom used to hit me. I fought with my brothers. I thought it was normal. She bargained for what safety she could, denying him sex, leaving town for a while, taking a blow, giving one back, demanding respect, not getting it, then getting it, provoking him, evading him, insisting on a condom, not insisting, not even wanting to insist, trusting, not trusting, and never once assuming that protection might rest with persons who were as much her oppressors as his. Finally, she'd had enough. When I first met Amber, I asked her about danger. And she said that before all the posters and the panic, HIV wasn't anywhere on a scale of 1 to 10. She hasn't been sheltered from AIDS. A cousin and her boyfriend died of it. Her stepsister's uncle died of it. His boyfriend was either positive or had AIDS when he moved away after the uncle died. She just didn't worry about it for herself, not in Jamestown. Her biggest fears, she said, were being in jail and being alone. Now she was both, not having heard from her latest man, the one whose name is tattooed on her stomach, the one she could really tell anything, the one who would not hit her. They had a fight. He doesn't write easily, has no phone, couldn't afford to accept the charges, wildly inflated if he did, and no ID. No one gets to visit the jail without ID. Somehow, it seemed too small to be talking about risk, but we talked about it anyway. What would life be like without putting yourself out there sometimes, she said. I tell this to my mother. My mother's life is this. She goes to work, goes to the bar. She's not a drinker or anything. She just goes there, goes home. Every day, go to work, go to the bar, go home. I asked her, what's the point, Mom? What is the point of your life? What could she say? There's nothing she could say. That's why I have to get out of Jamestown. It's not anything about the town, it's me. It makes me unhappy to be here, and I don't want to be unhappy. But do you think there are things you could do to protect yourself more from hurt? There's no way. No way. Because whatever you do, as long as you're alive, there's a scale of hurt. There's the kind of hurt you get from loving someone and the kind of hurt you get from keeping just to yourself and not letting yourself love nobody. So either you're going to get hurt because of someone you love or you're going to be lonely. Either way, you're hurting yourself. The point is, you're doing it to yourself. You're making the decision.
That was Joanne Wojcicki reading from her report on the Newshawn Williams case, The Secret Sharer. We're listening to literary journalists reading from their work this hour, and we'll be back with more after a short break. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners at WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News, the Literary Journalism Connection. We're listening to journalists read their work this hour, recorded at a conference in December. Charlie Pierce is well known to many public radio listeners as the hearty voice on Only a Game and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Charlie Pierce has been a forest ranger and a bowling reporter, a staff writer for both GQ and Esquire magazines. Here he's reading a section of a new memoir called Hard to Forget, an Alzheimer's story about the disease that struck his father and all his father's siblings. This reading is about one day in 1985 when Charlie Pierce's father drove off to the local flower store and disappeared for 3 days.
It was nearly Memorial Day. Every Memorial Day for almost 16 years, my father and I had gone to plant geraniums on the family graves in St. John's Cemetery in Worcester, where the Irish in Worcester had been planting their relatives for as long as there had been Irish in Worcester to plant. Every Memorial Day, my father and I would plant them first on the old sergeant's grave and then on the graves of my father's aunts and finally around the plot where lay Charlie Gibbons and the Duchess. And we always saved one flower for a mysterious cement cross, tiny and anonymous and mottled thick with lichens, near to where Charlie and the Duchess were buried. My father insisted on it. My mother rarely came with us. My mother was never much for graveyards. Shrewsbury looks very much like 100 other small New England towns. It has a pleasant wooded town common with an old bandstand at its heart. At the head of the common is the First Congregational Church, which has dominated the common for over 200 years. They were tearing up the center of town that day, and a construction crew had dug a trench across Main Street just short of the common. Traffic was being routed in an inverted U around the common and across in front of the First Congregational Church, down past the firehouse and the bandstand, and back onto Main Street along the common's westerly edge. That morning, after stopping at the flower store, my father waved at the cop on duty. I know he did. He always waved at policemen. He was a policeman's son. He drove northward up the east side of the common. He did not make the left turn in front of the First Congregational Church. He kept going north. 8 hours later, Margaret and Abraham and I got home just as the evening softened into night. As we walked in the door, the telephone was ringing, and that is the image that stayed with Margaret. The end of an idyllic day in the country, a new family with a baby on the way and a little boy thrilled to have ditched school in order to feed the ducks in a lake near the mountains. And there's a phone ringing out of the dark at the top of the stairs. He's gone, my mother told me on the telephone. He went to the store to buy flowers for the cemetery, and he's not home yet, and he hasn't called. And why hasn't he called? He always called before. That brought me up short. I'd never been told about the other failed errands or how he'd been putting on two pairs of pants. I had no idea what she was talking about, although I should have. I'd seen something there. It had come out on that drunken night on the telephone. Margaret had seen it when she first met him. Everybody had seen it at our wedding. Yet this catastrophic manifestation, an Alzheimer's term of art that I had learned later, was a complete shock to me. I drove out to Shrewsbury. Margaret stayed behind to arrange for her sister to pick up Abraham. Meanwhile, she recalled seeing a local doctor on television talking about the Alzheimer's Association. She called directory assistance. The operator could find no listing for the Alzheimer's Association. She called the television station. Nobody knew where the doctor was. She called the Massachusetts State Police, and she asked them to put on an all-points bulletin on my father. Well, a state policeman told her, you know that sometimes men at his age like to run off with their young secretaries. Finally, she told them that my father had a serious brain disease, which was an exaggeration, but also the truth. She told them he had to have his medication, or else he would start having seizures right there on the side of the highway. This made sense to the police. Brain disease, they could understand. Seizures, they could understand. The newspapers told her that they could run his picture once he'd been missing for 24 hours. I pulled into the driveway in Shrewsbury. I saw my mother's cigarette first, a single orange dot visible through the screens, waving through the air in the darkness of the porch. My mother was sitting in a corner. I could not see her face. Why hasn't he called? She kept asking me. I remember Thanksgiving the previous fall when the two of them came to dinner. I remember my father keeping his coat on, holding onto the leash of his new and unruly puppy. I remember my father holding onto the leash, refusing to take his coat off, and insisting from the time he came up the stairs that he had to go home. This is very nice, he said, but I have to go home now. But you haven't had dinner yet, I told him. Oh, he replied. Then he would make for the door again. You can't walk home, I'd say. It's too far. Oh, he replied. Then he would stand there and look out the window, the puppy ripping at his shoes. I remember this as we sat on the porch the night that my father disappeared. I'd seen it and not seen it. Instead, I asked my mother if he'd ever done anything like this before, and she said no, never, and I believed her, even though today it seems as credible as having been told that he'd gone to the moon on a scooter. Margaret arrived a few hours later. My mother and I were still on the porch talking about nothing, my mother insisting that she could not understand why my father hadn't called. If he's lost, she kept saying, why doesn't he just call? My wife did not grow up with the same reflexes that I did. Because, she snapped, maybe he doesn't remember his phone number. My mother fell into a furious silence, the dancing orange dot of another cigarette the only sign that she was there. We waited on the screen porch in the dark, rain beginning to fall harder outside from the west, from the Berkshires, where the day had begun. There was an old clock ticking somewhere in the house, and the phone did not ring. On Saturday, there was still no word. My mother had grown quite agitated, so we called a doctor in my family. My Uncle Jim prescribed some Valium for my mother. Jim had retired from active practice 4 years earlier, but of course, this being our family, I didn't know this. He had had a bout with diabetes and a slight stroke, and I didn't know this either. The rain fell harder in the north that weekend. About 250 miles away, it pummeled Montpelier. At 2 o'clock on Sunday morning, the rain awoke a woman who lived across the street from the state capitol building. She got up and idly looked out her front window. At a row of parking meters across the street, there was a man sitting in a light blue Granada. He appeared to be in his mid-60s. He had gray eyes and gray hair. He'd been there that afternoon, she remembered, occasionally getting out of the car to look around, being pelted by the rain. He was soaked to the bone now, and he was still there, sitting in his car, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. The woman called the police. Two cops pulled up alongside of the Granada. The man was pleasant enough, but he couldn't tell them his name. He couldn't tell them his address. He couldn't tell them his phone number. He was soaking wet, and he was almost incoherent, wondering aloud about his dog. The two cops came to the obvious sidewalk conclusion. It was a good thing this guy never got his car started. They took him to the police station, and they put him in the drunk tank to sleep it off. I began to wonder if my father was dead, shot at a roadside rest stop, or rolled off the highway by some cowboy trucker. Margaret was concerned about exposure, that he had simply run out of gas in the woods somewhere and would either die overnight or succumb to a pneumonia soon after. I thought my mother could handle his death. It would be hard, but she could find things to do. Maybe she'd even start playing the piano again. She'd stopped mysteriously about 5 years earlier. Nobody in the neighborhood knew why, and she would become furious if you asked her about it. Maybe she'd go back to the regular Tuesday night rosary coffee clutch that had meant so much to her when I was a boy. She stopped going to that, too, and when the ladies in the neighborhood asked her why, she would become furious and stop talking. Yes, I thought, my mother would be able to cope with my father's dying. She might even do fine with it. Sitting there on the porch as Sunday was coming up in my old neighborhood, I realized that I knew exactly where every shadow would fall. In the compass of my early life, I found myself parceling out my father's death. Then, The phone rang in the kitchen, and my mother said it was someone in Vermont. In the morning, the sergeant on duty at the drunk tank in Montpelier checked on the man who'd been brought in the night before from in front of the Capitol building. He was still pleasant, wondering about his dog. He still did not know his name or his address. He still did not know his phone number, but he was plainly sober. If there was an APB out on him, nobody had found it yet. It took a while, but they finally found out who he was. He'd been reporting missing in Massachusetts. Someone at the halfway house called the number that had been provided, and a woman answered. She said that his son would be coming up to get him and that, no, there was nothing wrong with him. He'd just gotten lost going to the store. The police handed him off to the county mental health officials. They dried him off and changed his clothes for him. They took him to Burger King, which he seemed to enjoy. Then they took him to a halfway house where he sat himself in a big leather armchair and listened to a basketball game on the radio. There's a game I play now when the waking dream comes. I make a deal with my father's disease. All right, I say. I will allow you to have some of my memories. You can have my first polio shot, all the lyrics to American Woman, 2 votes for Bill Clinton, and both Reagan administrations. Leave me my children's names. Let me know them, and you can have all 4 Marx Brothers. This is not clinical. I know the disease does not work this way. But sometimes I play this game anyway, and I'm very good at it. I was born to play it. I was raised to believe the truth is malleable and that you can bend it so that even its darkest part can be shaped into the familiar and commonplace. I can play this game. I can play it well. My mother stayed home. Margaret and I drove on a great diagonal north through New Hampshire and into Vermont. We stopped at a country store to buy sandwiches, and the counterwoman smiled at us. A young couple come into the country, the wife quite obviously pregnant. It was a bright spring afternoon, and the countryside seemed poised to bloom. Young hawks wheeled in the clear air. It was a long and lovely ride, and it was evening before we ever got to Montpelier. We went first to the police station, where they explained that my father had been transferred to the halfway house. There was a large sitting room with a fireplace and some overstuffed chairs. My father was sitting in one of the chairs, listening to a basketball game on the radio. One of the men that worked at the place told him that we'd come to take him home. He rose to greet us. He was smiling, but the smile never made it all the way to his eyes. The smile died before it got there, flattening out, dissipating. His eyes were blank as slate. I remember the warmth of the fire. I remember the hiss and the crackle of the wood. I remember that something happened in the basketball game that caused the announcer to get excited. At that moment, my wife took me across the room, and she introduced me to my father. "Nice to meet you," my father said. He was very concerned about his dog. He would not leave without his dog. He wanted to show us his dog. It was such a nice dog. "There he is now," my father said. "Where's your dog?" we asked him. "Over there," my father said, pointing to a corner of the room. "Your dog isn't there," I told him. "Your dog is at home in Shrewsbury, at your house." My father looked around the room. He called for his dog. "He's right over there," my father said, pointing toward a table. It was dark outside now. The neon in the bars along the tight little street glowed coldly. Margaret finally coaxed him into his coat, and we left. It was too late to drive all the way home, so we took a room in a motel along the main highway. We all went to dinner in the motel's lounge. The place turned out to be a local hotspot, with a piano player telling off-color jokes to people who laughed and sang with him, even though they all seemed familiar with his act. My father took a great shine to the piano player, laughing merrily along with the crowd. My father ordered his food, and I watched him talk. His conversation ran in small circles, like a tiny loop in a country railroad. He had a series of catchphrases that would keep him on course, like station stops. He still had his manners, not society manners like those of his Jesuit brother Michael, but a demeanor that once might have been called courtly. The waitress was charmed. He didn't exactly order his food. He waited for Margaret to order, and then he said, "I'll have that too." We finished dinner, and we went back to the room in order to go to bed. Margaret was exhausted. Nearly 4 months pregnant, she wasn't prepared to go herring off through the North Woods in pursuit of a man traveling with a dog that only he could see. My father got into bed. I lay on the other bed and watched him. Suddenly, he rose and bolted for the door. "My mother," he said. "My mother is out there and she wants me." He saw her. I have no doubt of that. The former Mary Ellen Lynch, the old sergeant's wife, was walking down the hallway of a motel in Montpelier, Vermont. She was calling to her son, John. She needed him to come home. She was calling to him and he was coming to her. He was out the door and running out into the hallway after her in his underwear. Margaret and I managed to catch him. He pushed back, pointing down the hallway and talking about his mother who needed him at home. We steered him back up the hallway. He needed to go home. His mother needed him and he had to go back. We told him he could call her on the telephone. We told him that his mother wanted him to go to bed. We told him we could settle everything in the morning. We got him back into the room. We put him back to bed and he fell asleep finally. We moved a dresser in front of the door. I lay awake a long time that night. I listened to the rumble of the trucks that passed along the highway outside, shaking the walls of the motel. I watched their lights dance through the window and then move through the room, one after another, up the walls and across the ceiling, and then gone again out the window. I watched my father sleep. He slept as he'd always slept. He was not seeing dogs that were not there. He was not running to his dead mother. I knew him now. He was my father again. The next morning, before he woke, I moved the dresser away from the door. Margaret had decided to drive my father back in our car. It was smaller and it would not be as comfortable, but she at least was used to driving it, and she thought that I'd appreciate the chance to drive back alone in the Granada. I drove ahead of them, concentrating fiercely on the road, and every so often I would look in the rearview mirror. Margaret would wave at me. In the passenger seat, my father would smile. They chatted amiably as though they'd known each other for years, my father on that roundabout circuit that had become normal for him, Margaret along for the ride. My father pointed out the windshield at me, hunched over the wheel of his car. "He's a nice little fellow," said my father to my wife. "Yes, he is," said my wife. "He's a great little fellow for helping us out," my father said. "Yes, he is," said my wife. "My wife is going to kill me," my father said. "What is your wife's name?" said my wife. "I don't know," my father said, "but my wife is going to kill me. She is going to kill me." "We'll explain it to her, and it will be okay," said my wife. "My wife is going to kill me," my father said. I drove on ahead of them, concentrating fiercely. Every so often, I would look in the rearview mirror. "You know, I think I'm going to give him that car," my father said. "Really?" said my wife. "He's a great little fellow for helping us out," my father said. We stopped in a McDonald's for lunch. My father liked the idea of McDonald's. He seemed to enjoy all the children darting in and out between the tables. We asked him what he wanted, and he said he would have what we were having, and that would be fine. We had not ordered yet. Margaret brought the food back to the table. I leaned across, and I thought I'd tell my father that he was going to be a grandfather. I spoke to him without thinking. I spoke to him as though he knew that I was his son and that he was my father. It would not be the only time that I did this. It would not be the last time that I did this. It was the first time I did this. "You know, Dad," I said, pointing to Margaret, "she's going to have a baby." My father blanched. Plainly, he believed that we were telling him that he was the father of my wife's baby. All he had done was taken a ride with this woman. What was this nice little fellow accusing him of? He tried to speak, and he couldn't, and we stopped him before he could run out of the restaurant. He grew more anxious as we got closer to home. He kept insisting that his wife was going to kill him, and Margaret kept assuring him that everything would be fine, that his wife would understand. Even she has to notice this now, Margaret thought. He's been missing for 3 days. She has to see that something's not right with him. We drove back into Shrewsbury from the north. The street was still torn up in the center of town. It was Monday afternoon, and my father was coming home from the flower store. "My wife is going to kill me," said my father. We pulled into the driveway. My mother was sitting on the porch smoking. My father walked up his driveway with tiny steps as though he were barefoot on hot sand. My mother swung open the door. "Well, Johnny," she boomed, "the next time you're leaving, why don't you send me a postcard?" My father went back up the stairs and into his house, and the screen door whanged shut behind him. Margaret and I stood in the driveway, Margaret looking as though she'd seen something distant and dreadful behind the screen door. I knew what was going to happen. We were going to pretend now. We were going to pretend that my father didn't go to the flower store and end up in Vermont. We were going to pretend that he could still order his own food. We were going to pretend that he didn't chase his dead mother down a motel corridor. I felt the truth bending inside me, turning the last 3 mad days into some familiar shape, and I realized what I was feeling was relief. I leaned back against the Granada. I'd driven nearly 250 miles in that car, and I'd never noticed that the back seat was full of geraniums and that on the dashboard, the little compass had been moved away from the Blessed Virgin and into a spot right in front of the steering wheel. At some point during the drive north, my father had pulled the compass over in front of him so that he could see it, so that it could lead him home. It was still there, the rubber tube weighting it down in its place. The compass was broken. Floating inside its little plastic bubble, the dial bobbed aimlessly, never fastening on one specific direction, floating free.
That was Charlie Pierce reading from his new memoir, Hard to Forget, about his family's struggle with Alzheimer's disease. Mark Kramer is the author of Three Farms, Making Milk, Meat, and Money from the American Soil. Also the book Invasive Procedures, A Year in the World of Two Surgeons. Also Travels with a Hungry Bear. Mark Kramer is a professor of journalism and a writer in residence at Boston University. This is an excerpt from invasive procedures.
Two student nurses, one fine-boned, doe-eyed, notably attractive. The other sturdy, coarse-skinned, and plainer stand timidly inside the doorway of the operating room where Stern helps prepare a patient for a carotid endarterectomy. The students are already masked, although no one else in the room is yet. Everyone knows the routine, and there's little point in lowering one's mask until the sterile draping is getting underway. "May we come in to observe?" the fine-boned one asks, nearly whispering. "Not until I see who you are," says Stern. He walks over and lifts her mask away from her face. She averts her eyes. Then he playfully pulls the other student's cap down until it's pressing into her eyes. For the first 45 minutes of the surgery, they watch attentively and are ignored. With no one explaining what's happening or why, they stand on low stools behind Stern's back. Stern isolates the carotid artery from the complex anatomy of the patient's neck. He prepares clamps to close down blood flow through it. After clamping, he has 10 minutes to do his work and restore circulation. It's one of the few surgical procedures that routinely entails tense, concentrated minutes. A nurse clicks a stopwatch and reports each minute gone. 9, she says, then 8. Stern slices open the artery and cleans out the mat of plaque that narrows it. He's deft and efficient. In only 6.5 minutes, he's ready to close, and he has the slit partially stitched up in another 30 seconds. 3 minutes, says the nurse. With such surgery, the surgeon must release the clamped artery for a moment before completing the stitching, so the strong back pressure of blood can flush out fresh clotting. If the wound is sealed without this flushing, clots might be pushed onward toward the brain. Stern glances behind him, taking measure of the student nurses. As he unclamps, he steps sideways. A fat pulse of blood spits from the artery and loops through the air past him like a hurled Bloody Mary. It lands with precision, spattering the prettier student nurse's bare arm and leg and streaking across her dress. Playing with blood here is not as grave a sacrilege as it may sound at first. In surgery, blood seems of little consequence. It's like money in the middle of a poker game. One's notion of its value changes excitingly. In fact, Stern had done a similar thing to me the first time I'd seen him performing an operation months earlier. I thought of it then as an initiation ritual, a hazing that had touched me with blood, nasty but counting me in. Perhaps it's that again, but the circulating nurse sees this repetition of the event in a different light. "Here, look what he did," she says in a comforting voice. She looks disgusted. She reaches out and touches the student. She swabs the blood off the student's arm and leg with a sterile towel, deflecting attention from the intrusion, avoiding trouble. The student says, "Oh, I don't care. It's not my dress." "Doctors are little boys, and we treat them like that," says the circulating nurse. Meanwhile, Stern's attention remains on the procedure. He quickly finishes the repair and has the carotid sealed and unclamped, just as the nurse calls 1 minute. He's completed a technically demanding procedure without incident. Formal report for carotid surgery. Normal interior carotid stenosis proceeding medially. We identified the carotid sheath. Careful, sharp, and blunt dissection were pursued. In coming weeks, the patient thrives. The student nurses have learned things they must know about surgeons, if not about surgery.
That was Mark Kramer reading from his book, Invasive Procedures. Thank you, Mark Kramer, Charlie Pierce, Joanne Wojcicki, and Tracy Kidder. This hour of The Connection was produced by John Holt, with help from George Hicks, Keith Shields, Mary McGrath, and Glenn Alexander, and with special thanks to Professor Mark Kramer. The Connection website is www.theconnection.org. Our web producer is Jim Norris. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Our senior producer is Mary McGrath. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Alaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Delta Dental Plan of Massachusetts, encouraging listeners to see their dentist regularly. It's good for teeth and overall health. 1-800-DELTA-US. Digital Graphics, providing companies new marketing tools through the innovative use.